Hello, a belated Happy New Year, and welcome to the 30th episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. You can subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. There's also, of course, the Facebook page and the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, which are both looking for followers. And you can also stay up to date with the latest posts by subscribing at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, if you enjoy or benefit in some way from this podcast and you want to support it and me, you can do so via my Patreon account. That will let you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. You can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. Also, help in another way by rating or reviewing this podcast on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use, which will help flag up Turkey Book Talk for other people who don't yet know about it. But now let's get on with this milestone 30th episode. In it, I speak to Simon Waldman of King's College London and Emre Çalışkan of Oxford University about their new book, The New Turkey and Its Discontents, which is published by Hearst. The book is a very good primer of the fundamentals of how Turkey got to where it is today over the past few decades. In recent years, the country has gone from an optimistic, shining star, emerging economy, praised by everyone, to a struggling state with serious political, security, and economic woes. I started by asking Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan to summarise how that process happened. Simon was the first to speak.
When we wanted to write this book, one of the first things that we were thinking about was actually the role of the military. And what we kind of noticed is that the military's involvement in politics is something which is, of course, against democratic principles. But why was it, as the military got weaker in terms of its ability to be involved in political affairs, that this did not lead to greater democracy? It was really from that lens that we wanted to analyze Turkey. And you ask a good question about, you know, this idea of Turkey being this shining star. Was it ever really the shining star? Was it ever the kind of the model, if you like, for other Muslim countries to emulate? And, you know, the clear answer to that was no. And I don't even think the AKP ever believed that it was. If you recall, the AKP used to say, especially after the Arab Spring, no, we are not the model. We are an example, but we're not necessarily the model, because, of course, they were concerned about what kind of spotlight that would shine on Turkey. Quite frankly, after 9/11, the Western world, if you like, the United States, Europe, they needed a model of a Muslim democracy. And in many respects, the idea that Turkey was this shining light for other countries to follow was a construct, was a Western construct, which just didn't have any factual grounding. And I'm not just talking about the rise of the AKP here, especially post-second term politics or into the third term politics. I'm talking about even the more recent political history, looking into the 1990s, and as I said, the military's involvement in politics post-1997, or even into the 1980s, or even before that, into the 1970s, 60s. You just don't have Turkey as this democratic model, this shining light and example to follow whatsoever. And if there is any kind of period where Turkey looked good, it was actually just a very short period in its longer history of the 20th century into the 21st century. And that's 5 years up around 2007. So no, the way I see it is that the idea of Turkey as this kind of model shining light was a construct.
I think I should jump in now. Also, I agree with what Simon said, but also we tried to understand why Turkey couldn't become democratic when the role of military is demolished in Turkish politics. The reason why military was powerful, we argue this is an indicator of a weak state. So basically, there was an attempt in Turkey after the 2001 financial crisis with the IMF and EU reforms to build up independent organizations, which eventually could be check and balances in Turkish politics after the post-military era. But actually, the check and balances or the independent organization couldn't improve when we look at the Turkish trajectory. So instead of seeing a strong democratic and Muslim society, we see again different trend, which the charismatic leaders is actually dominating the political landscape, and the Turkey is more divisive, is more fragmented than before, actually.
You mentioned there that the book really focuses on this idea that of military tutelage and the military's role in politics declining, and that being the kind of big narrative over the last 15 or so years. But I was thinking as I read it also that it's almost only a particular idea of the Turkish military. This idea of, you know, the tutelary role of the military in Turkish politics. But it's become kind of clear in particularly in recent months, even despite this recent coup last summer, that this kind of prestige and reverence for the military and particularly for the individual soldier remains undimmed in Turkish society. Mm. If anything, maybe that reverence is even stronger. Because according to a lot of the government kind of propaganda, the armed forces are now arm in arm with the kind of nation rather than loftily above it. Wonder if you could just comment on this idea of the military as one thing having this role, but also the military in a broader kind of sense also still being very potent in Turkish society today.
Well, indeed. I mean, when it comes to the AKP or President Erdogan and their kind of perspective on the military, I would say that, you know, throughout their time in office up until right now, what they've been trying to engage in is not necessarily the decimation of the military, but rather refining the military into the barracks. And in addition to that, making Turkey a coup-proof state to stop any potential coup from taking place. When we talked when we were doing the research for our book, we talked to people who were either from the AKP or sympathetic towards the AKP. And they told us that nearly all the time they received some kind of report or some kind of intelligence that there could be a coup on the horizon. And this was something that they were always concerned of and looking over their shoulders in case that would ever take place. So what the AKP were trying to do was to coup-proof the country. And I would actually say that this was quite successful. Even though there was an attempted coup in July, it remained an attempted coup. It failed. And at the same time, Turkey is still an embattled state, and it would be disastrous if the prestige of the military was also attacked. And the AKP had to kind of separate those two things, even though that process itself is quite difficult to do.
And also from the historical perspective, Turkish army has been praised as the guardian of the secularism and the national interest. And actually, the reason why Turkish army has came to the point before the AKP is because of the Kurdish insurgency in the country. Starting from the 1980 coup and throughout the 90s, the role of the army has been increased. Actually, in the book, we argue there are two capitals of Turkey. One was in Ankara. The Ankara government was in charge of the politics, like in local politics. But on the other hand, in the southeastern part of the country, there was another government, which is actually, it was the army who is playing or acting like as a state builder. We talked to some of the top star retired generals, and they were referring how they were actually building schools, building hospitals, and combating with terrorism. And when they came back to Ankara after their time in the southeastern part of Turkey, they were stronger in a sense to interfere the politics. And the biggest success of the AKP through the EU reforms is to cut off the power of the army. Of course, this came with the price, with the baggage, which the role of the army in the eyes of the Turkish people has been triggered, demolished. So today, AKP try to recreate a new image for the army, it is like a national army, as if it wasn't a national army before, or it is like a army, which it is an army controlled by the mostly government, the coup-proof army.
Now, taking a look at the kind of broader trend of Turkish democracy and institutions, people often talk about the coup as a kind of fundamental turning point, but in many ways, the negative trends were already in evidence before the coup, and the process that we've seen in the aftermath of that coup attempt have just been an acceleration of a trend that was already ongoing. What do you think about that?
I would agree with you. Those who have been watching Turkey even before the coup had noted that there have been different purges taking place within different organs of state, different institutions. There were already different suspensions within the police force after Agenikon and Barrios, those cases. There were similar kind of purges, if you like, and resignations happening in the armed forces. And it goes on into different institutions, including the judiciary. And then, of course, after the coup itself, we see this taking place at rapid speed and under a state of emergency. The question is, why? What is the government really trying to do here? And, you know, what seems apparent here is that Erdogan and his AKP government is trying to strengthen the state. They're trying to make the state stronger because there's a significant problem within Turkey's institutions. If it is true, as the AKP say, that there is a nefarious organization loyal to an Islamic preacher based in the United States, and not loyal to the state itself, it's indicative of the Turkish state as being weak, and this needs to be strengthened. The problem with this is that at the cost of strengthening the state, the democratic institutions are also being weakened at the same time. And that kind of brings us to where we are right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the success of Erdogan governments in the past was to create and emerge new alliances. When AKP came to power, it was the Gulen movement who actually aligned with the government, and in response, Gulen movement people and supporters were promoted in the state institutions. But since 2013, the Gulen movement people were being sidelined. But now, the Erdogan government is trying to have new alliances with different religious groups or with different political groups, such as nationalist or like another religious group called Menzil or Süleymancı's or different groups. But the problem is here, the government doesn't allow like more secular people or more the people based on the meritocracy. The idea is to fill this post who are loyal to the government. Then we can't see the actual rise of the independent institutions in Turkish democracy.
Indeed, and just to add on that, so the result of what Emre just said is that instead of strengthening the state and strengthening state institutions and apparatus, it's actually weakening those institutions because it's doing the same thing over again. This time it's not the Fethullah Gulen movement, it's other individuals, but they all have their own allegiances, alliances or ideologies. And that takes precedence over loyalty to the state. In one of our interviews that we had, and I'll keep the interviewee anonymous, we just asked the question, why can it not be the case that individuals get their promotions, get their positions within the bureaucracy based on merit? And he just went up in arms. What do you mean merit? And that just goes to show kind of the problems that Turkey is having.
Yeah, I think this is a really key point, this question of meritocracy and groups fighting over the state and it being this kind of seen as this existential fight for everybody, which has huge consequences. And that kind of leads nicely onto this next question that I want to address, actually, because we're seeing so many terrorist attacks at the moment, and there seems to be a huge situation of state incapacity, really. And there's a huge weakness at the heart of the security institutions that can't prevent these attacks from happening. And it really worsens the atmosphere all round. And I wonder, I sometimes think that this has kind of accelerated in the aftermath of the coup. There's much to say about Gulenist misdeeds and dirty tricks, and you know, many Gulenists who are in the state probably do belong in jail for criminal activity. But these kind of massive purges that we're seeing in state institutions have obviously led to some of these huge security weaknesses that are evident today. So in a way, there's a real paradox there. The Gulen sympathizers really are or were a state security threat, but getting rid of so many of them itself creates enormous security problems.
Indeed.
Yeah, definitely. So in each country, when you are trying to combat in terrorism, you need actually strong intelligence system, and which is a long-term project. Basically, the intelligence officer has to establish good relation with the informant. And so in many cases, the informant started early ages and recruit throughout the time and then become influential, you see, and you can actually get the sources and prevent the attacks. In the case of Turkey, Turkey keeps changing the police officers in each like a minimum or maximum 5 years. So the relation between the informant and the intelligence officers has cut off all the time when the new changes. And at the same time, intelligence office organization should share the intelligence between each other. When you look at Turkey, you have MIT, like a Turkish secret organization, you have gendarma, you have police intelligence, and there is no consensus among the state organizations as well. So basically, on top of that, Turkey is also fighting with many enemies in Syria, Iraq, PKK, and ISIS. So basically, we see the state in crisis in combating national security threat.
Indeed, I mean, and just to add to that, everything that Emery said, I agree with there. But we have to also look at this and say, okay, let's say Turkey is in a state of change. In the post-coup environment, there has to be some kind of rearrangement within the security apparatus to make sure that another attempted coup cannot take place. Fine, but that means that Turkey has limited resources in combating both the PKK and the Islamic State. And one of the things that Turkey hasn't really been able to do is to choose its enemies or to prioritize which enemy to go after first. And, you know, in Ankara, they have to decide with this limited resources, whether that's temporary or long term, there has to be a prioritization. Who is the main threat? Is it Islamic State or is it the PKK? And if it is the Islamic State, then there has to be an attempt to somehow seek some kind of temporary ceasefire with the PKK and then go after the Islamic State full force with all of its resources and then return to the PKK if nothing has come out of that ceasefire. But there's a reason, of course, why this will not happen. And that is, if Ankara and if Erdogan tries to have any kind of rapprochement with the PKK, kind of relaunching like kind of early phases of the peace process that we saw a few years ago, the MHP will not support Erdogan's presidential ambitions. So instead, the security of the whole state is compromised because of the ambitions of the president to change the system into one that will give him more powers. And that's the kind of situation that we're seeing here. So it's also a political choices which are to blame for the deteriorating security circumstances.
Yeah, I do want to address that actually. It really beggars belief that this prospective referendum looks like it's going to go ahead in the current environment. It's hard to imagine. I mean, I just don't even want to think about it. I don't think many people want to think about it. Like, thinking of the really tense atmosphere that we have at the moment, and then throwing into that a really divisive referendum campaign doesn't seem like a very good idea.
No, and just to add to that, let's not forget that at the moment Turkey's in a state of emergency. A state of emergency is really for an emergency period to give the government particular powers to deal with a security situation and then go back to normal civilian life. And what could potentially happen is that instead of the state of emergency being temporary, it ushers in a completely different political system than the one before. And that's completely contrary to any kind of democratic practices. If there is a desire to change the constitution, it needs to be debated. If there's a desire to change the political system, it needs to be debated openly. And it's not just the state of emergency. Even before the July coup, any kind of attempt to change the constitution, would it have been fully debated in the press with openness and clarity, with everyone having equal airtime for those who oppose it and didn't oppose it? We're fairly certain that would not have been the case. And now, under the state of emergency, it certainly won't be the case. And that's what makes it so terrifying and frightening.
And I want to go one click further. Actually, I want to focus on what would happen in the post-Erdogan era. Basically, Erdogan had been a divisive figure in Turkish politics, but at the same time, he was a unifier figure. What keeps united Kurds, some secularists or Alevis, is being their opposition to Erdogan. Or on the other side, what unites some nationalists and different religious groups is also the support of Erdogan. So basically, we focus on the Erdogan's charisma in the constitutional change. But when we look at the post-Erdogan era, who will unite, or who will unite these people? And then Turkey is being more fragmented. So either you will always have a very strong leaders, charismatic leaders. In the absence of the strong charismatic leaders, the country might be in the edge of the civil war.
Just very quickly, do you want to make any prediction for any for this referendum?
Well, you know, these kind of things are hard, and I'm actually going to kind of avoid the question, but I'll give you a rationale, a kind of a reason why I'll avoid the question. Predictions in Turkey are something that I kind of always kind of get asked. Maybe it's the tradition of like the reading the Turkish coffee cup into the future, which, by the way, I'm getting pretty good at. It's the kind of the idea of like wanting to see in the future what's going to happen. Well, the thing is, it's really difficult to predict that in Turkey because we don't get a full and open picture. I don't have all the facts at our disposal. So, for example, I'd really, really, really like to have some kind of equivalent of Hansard. But so that's the British parliamentary debates, which are kind of recorded in full and open access to everyone. I'd really like to have the kind of equivalent in Turkey, and also to kind of be able to have full kind of disclosure as to what takes place within different minutes of parties and things like that, and able to answer questions such as that. But so far, I'm not able to have that kind of access. So even right now, when we look at the bits and pieces that we get into what looking at what the kind of the new political system of Turkey would be like, it may not be what the referendum is about in who knows how much time in the next few months.
And maybe on top of that, I would say, I want to mention what makes Erdogan government possible is the success of the economy, or is the relative success of the economy. The Erdogan years, for many Turkish people, resembles economic growth and the change of lifestyle, increasing public services. What makes Erdogan government or presidential system possible, I argue, is the economic success. And now, Turkey's economy is under getting into troubled times. The private loans are increasing, economic growth is getting down, the export and import numbers are slowing down, the dollar is getting stronger, the trade deficit is getting higher. So basically, even the referendum itself, or the events after the referendum, will be very much binded to Turkish economic success.
Yeah, that's really true. And something else as well to kind of look out for is the opinion polls. Something that Emre and I kind of like noted is that when or if Erdogan makes a bold move, there's usually opinion polls that would indicate that this will be successful. So, you know, if the opinion polls kind of show that the referendum will just be too close to call, I doubt that he'll take the political risk. But if it goes around 54-55% of Turks are willing to support such changes, then he will probably go ahead with it, because that's something that he pays a lot of attention to.
Yes, I want to address the economic question in relation to the referendum. But first, I mean, just going back to this Gulen question, just to play kind of devil's advocate here, I know a lot of pro-government people would say that, you know, there's this constant refrain of, well, you let them in to the state in the first place, you promoted them, and you're responsible for allowing them to spread because you were in alliance with them for years. But they would say, and they have said implicitly, that they simply didn't have the kind of expertise to run the state, and they needed Gulenists to administer various institutions, and that's why they allowed them to spread. And they were, you know, this classic phrase, kandırıldık, you know, we were fooled. What do you make of that argument, the idea that, you know, they just didn't have the cadres, so this was necessary at the time, and now they've suddenly realised that they were wrong and they're atoning for this in the crackdown that we see now?
Can I go first for this question, Simon? So I think Turkish people do not buy this argument, or Turkish experts do not buy this argument, because to what makes Turkey different than the other countries is the increasing number of civil society organizations and actually increasing middle-class people. So basically, Erdogan government wanted to work with somebody who doesn't drink alcohol or who are more pious. But in fact, in Turkey, there are so many people who can fill this post, and based on the meritocracy, of course, and who can do much better things. But if you only rely on the one group of the people, you'll be always face this reality, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I'm inclined to agree with Emre there. It's a case of, you know, there is certainly enough people who are available to fill such posts and have the relevant expertise. But it's a question of, were they our kind of people, was the kind of mentality I think was there. And it was really a case of identity politics. Now, again, we don't have the full picture, even though in the kind of the post-coup period there's been a parliamentary inquiry, there hasn't been a public inquiry. And I think unless there's a real public inquiry and greater openness and transparency as to what was the relationship and the nature between the AKP and the Gulen movement, that, you know, these kind of arguments that the government can always say, oh, we kind of needed them, we didn't have the expertise, they fooled us, can always be said. But the reality is, from people that we talk to, not many people really buy that.
And just going back to this question of the economy that we flagged up there, we've seen in recent months the warning signs flashing red. And as Emre mentioned there, a lot of people believe that an economic crash will inevitably harm the AKP and the support of Erdogan, which could be critical during this referendum, this probable referendum. But I wonder if the atmosphere at the moment is such that economic problems might only exacerbate this kind of siege mentality and just further rally support behind Erdogan and his narrative that economic troubles are all just part of this great multi-pronged global assault on Turkey and the Turkish government. What do you think the effect of this economic trouble will be on the near future of Turkish politics?
Actually, we face many interesting experiences in our fieldworks in Turkey while writing this book, and we thought most of the business groups might support Erdogan in this extent, but when we talk to people in Turkish economy, in Turkish foreign policy, they always, you know, on record, they always talk like a, you know, usual story when what we hear in the newspapers. But when we turn the voice recorder off, they start to criticize Erdogan governments, and those are the ones who are actually supporting Erdogan quite strongly. And they criticize Turkey's Syrian policy, which have dramatic impact on Gaziantep or other emerging cities like Anatolian bourgeois cities, Anatolian tiger cities. All they criticize Turkey's big mega projects, which always go to same 5-6 groups, and who are not actually conservative, who are quite secular groups historically, and they want to have like a share of the big projects. And also they were concerned about the using of the public loans, which were also only distributed to some big groups. Basically, you can clearly see that even though some Turkish groups supporting Erdogan publicly, when you talk to them, especially the business groups, the conservative business groups, they are quite concerned on the direction of Turkish economy.
Yeah, and not just the economy as well. They're also concerned of things such as corruption and even political affairs as well. So there are discontents within the AKP, even by the AKP's own supporters. The economy is really the kind of the primary concern of some of those people. However, at the other end of the spectrum, there certainly are many people in Turkey who are traditional AKP supporters who will stand by Erdogan and the AKP through thick and thin, and they will buy the kind of the narrative that he says at rallies and at press conferences and things like that. The question is about that floating voter, and I think there's around 10% of the AKP supporters who are willing to float if there is a credible alternative and vote elsewhere. The question is there a credible alternative? And at the moment, there seems not. So yeah. Until there is an alternative, they will remain supporting the AKP and Erdogan, even though off the record, they'll be complaining about it.
I suppose there was a kind of good micro example of that in 2015, you know, in July, in the June election. I think some of these floating voters felt the luxury to kind of drift away, and they did. And surprisingly, the AKP lost its parliamentary majority. But then when terrorist attacks stepped up again and the clashes between the military and the PKK ramped back up again and there was this threat of insecurity, a lot of them rallied back to the AKP and delivered it the majority in November. So we had there this kind of example where when the luxury was there to express displeasure, they did. But when things really looked in trouble, they opted for stability.
Indeed, indeed. And that's an interesting kind of case, the kind of the June election, because don't forget that was an election where it wasn't Erdogan who was being elected as prime minister. It was the AKP without him. In this case, it was Ahmet Davutoğlu. And I really want to know more information about the constitution, the constitutional changes in the presidential system. If it is, from what I'm reading it, that it is, that there will be parliamentary elections, which will happen, you know, kind of at the same time, but will not directly lead to the president being elected. So in other words, a complete kind of a separation in those two elections. It could be a case where the popularity of Erdogan is something separate from the popularity of the AKP. In other words, Erdogan could be elected in a couple of years as president, but over a parliament which is does not have a majority of the AKP. And I think what we're going to see is going to see like the AKP making sure that in any changes to the system which take place, that they can make sure that they can guarantee that the AKP retains its popularity. This is one of the reasons why in this kind of proposed changes, they want to have 600 deputies instead of 550 deputies within parliament, because there's a possibility here of kind of gerrymandering, if you like, to make sure that the AKP will retain its strength. But it's important to note from that June elections, that that's kind of what I took away from it, is that the popularity of Erdogan and the popularity of the AKP are not the same thing.
But also, at the same time, there's a constant conflict or constant attempt in the AKP trying to decrease the influence or the popularity of the other political leaders. Because when the AKP was first established, we see three big legs of the party, Gül, Arınç and Erdoğan. But now, Gül and even the Erdoğan's guy, Davutoğlu, were all sidelined. So Erdoğan is clearly not interested in sharing his popularity. And he wants to call the shots of the party.
Yeah, indeed, because it's a really difficult situation. So under the new kind of changes that are being proposed, the president can be part of a political party, but won't necessarily be the leader of a political party. And then a political party with the absence of a leader, or with a leader who is being challenged by that of the president, might find themselves not receiving the votes that they were actually hoping to possibly receive.
That was Simon Waldman, and before him was co-author Emre Çalışkan. We were discussing their book, The New Turkey and Its Discontents, which is newly published by Hearst. You can read my review of that book at the Hürriyet Daily News. Remember, rate or review the Turkey Book Talk podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast if you haven't already. Follow the Twitter account or like the Facebook page, or do both, to stay updated with new episodes. Email me with recommendations, feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And don't forget that if you enjoy this podcast and you want to help me keep it going, you can support via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Beyarslan, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode, it's farewell from me, and thank you once again for listening. Tellidir, tellim anam, tellidir, tellidir amma.